So last week we looked at Revelation chapter 16, the final judgments of God falling upon mankind, what is described as bold judgments administered by angels. Revelation 15:1, in them these judgments, the wrath of God is finished. The sixth bold judgment is an unusual judgment where God allows the nations to gather together at Armageddon to war against God. And it's called the War of the Great Day of God Almighty. And the amazing truth, as we discussed last week, is that in the end, the nations turn to physically battle against God. And God allows it so that the enemies of God walk into their own judgment. In the seventh bold judgment, there's a great earthquake. All of the cities of the nations fall. Every island sinks and every mountain is moved. This happens either right before or during or immediately after the gathering at Armageddon. But now in chapter 17, we're given a vision of the evil system that's being destroyed in God's judgments upon the world. Revelation 17:1, then one of the seven angels who had seven bowls came and spoke with me, saying, "Come here, I will show you the great judgment. I will show you the judgment of the great harlot who sits on many waters." Now, we're specifically being told here in chapter 17, 18, that we're receiving a separate vision, a flashback, a pause, explaining the evil world system that God's judging. Verse 2, with whom the kings of the earth committed acts of immorality, and those who dwell on the earth were made drunk with the wine of her immorality. And he carried me away into the wilderness. And I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast full of blasphemous names, having seven heads and 10 horns. The woman was clothed in purple and scarlet, adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls, having in her hand a golden cup full of abominations and of the unclean things of her immorality. And on her forehead, a name was written, a mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots, the abomination of the earth. And so we're being told here that what's being judged is an entity called the great harlot and the beast. And the picture is of an immoral woman sitting on a beast. Here is a picture from Martin Luther's Bible in the 15th century. Here's another medieval picture. And then, of course, there are modern versions of what John may have seen. The title in the bulletin for this morning's message is The Great Harlot, which seems kind of inappropriate for a church sermon. But I couldn't think of any better title than what the text says. So we have to begin with a question we should always ask whenever we're in any text of Scripture. Why is this chapter included in the Bible? And what moral spiritual lessons are being given to us to help further our Christ-likeness in holiness and truth? Now, here is where the casual reader, when they read about these images or these illustrations in the book of the Revelation, they see them as nonsense. Just as someone said to me this week, after I told him that I was doing a series on the book of the Revelation, he said to me, "Wasn't Revelation just wild dreams about monsters, like we all have dreams?" Others may respond with more superficial understanding of the text, that this word about the great harlot is merely a prohibition against prostitution, which is true, but it means a whole lot more than that. For God's people, those who know the word, these illustrations are very common and easily understood. And we'll find that the book of the Revelation itself explains all of the imagery here, especially in Revelation 17, such as in verse 12, the 10 horns are 10 kings. In verse 15, the waters are nations and people. Verse 18, the woman is the great city. Now, in regard to harlotry, the first metaphor here, in the Old Testament, a reference to harlotry was commonly used as an illustration of substituting the true worship of God for some false religion, such as Jeremiah 3:9 came about because of the lightness of her harlotry, that she polluted the land and committed adultery with stones and trees, referring to the Israelites turning from God and worshiping nature. Ezekiel 16, you built yourselves a shrine and made yourselves a high place in every square, you adulterous wife who takes strangers instead of her husband. And Hosea chapter 4, verse 12, my people consult their wooden idols, and their diviner's wand informs them, For a spirit of harlotry has led them astray, and they have played the harlot, departing from their God. So there is physical, moral immorality, but also there's a spiritual immorality. And God uses this illustration, or uses marriage, the institution of marriage, to describe his relationship with his people, both in the Old and the New Testament. And Christians are called the bride of Christ, especially here in the Revelation. Revelation 19:7, for the marriage of the Lamb has come, and the bride has made herself ready. Revelation 21:9, come here, I will show you the bride, the wife of the Lamb. Revelation 22:17, the Spirit and the bride say, come. And even in the epistles, being spiritually united with the world and not united with God is described as spiritual moral adultery. James 4:4, you adulteresses and adulterers, do you not know that friendship with the world is hostility toward God? So let's just pause for a moment, set aside all the technical prophetic symbolism here, and reflect on the fact that a relationship with God, with the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, is to be as close and as faithful as our marital relationship. Marriage and love of marriage is to be an earthly example of our relationship with God. It's a way that we can learn to love God and others. But now here in the Revelation, we are introduced to this great harlot, which is definitely describing for us an imposter bride, an illegitimate relationship. And it's here where most commentators see the great harlot as representing false religion down through the ages, rather than the true bride of Christ, his people. But there's another group on earth who are not the bride. They are the great harlot, unbelievers who turn away from Christ. And the great harlot is said to sit on many waters. As we looked at earlier in the book of the Revelation, the sea and many waters refer to the sea of humanity. Revelation 13:1, the beast, this future globalist empire, comes out of the sea of humanity. Isaiah 17 uses the same image. Alas, the uproar of many people who roar like the roaring of the sea, and the rumbling of the nations who rush on like the rumbling of mighty waters. The nations rumble on like the rumbling of many waters. And if that doesn't make it plain, look at Revelation 17:15. It simply tells us the waters which you saw where the harlot sits are many people, multitude, and nations and tongues. So the prophecy interprets itself. So this false religion, sitting upon or imposing itself on the nations, notice verse 2, it says the governments of the world are associated with or involved with or supportive of this false religion. And this is seen also in the fact that the great harlot rides on top of the beast, the empire, and is supported by the beast, the empire. And as we saw earlier in the book of the Revelation and in the book of Daniel, the beast is a description of the empires of men. And not only are the governments of this world supporting the great harlot, it says here they're deluded by this great harlot, by this false ideology, being spiritually blinded and spiritually drunk. Now, most commentators, especially the older ones, associate the harlot specifically with apostate forms of Christianity. Because, especially during the Reformation, that was the false religion of their time and the only thing in their purview. But the harlot doesn't just represent apostate forms of Christianity. It would include also Hinduism and Buddhism, Islam, ancient forms of idolatry, coming out of ancient Babylon, the worship of Baal, Artemis, Zeus, Moloch, even in Romanism, wedding Christianity with various forms of paganism. But I also believe we need to include in the definition of the great harlot secular humanism, communism, utilitarianism, Darwinism, and you can add a dozen other isms to that, because those are also religions. They're the worship of man. Today, we don't call them religions, but they are very much biblically defined as false religions. All falsehoods are religions, really. It's a false worldview. It's a false view of man, a self-righteousness. It's a false view of God. It's a false way to salvation. And if you study all the false religions and the false secular ideologies in the world, they're really one. They're all about man's goodness and man's perfectibility, and salvation and deliverance comes through man's self-righteousness. And everyone who follows the false theology or ideology of this world, they're not the bride of Christ, but they're the great harlot. And another reason we should understand that the great harlot encompasses more than what's just defined as religion is the fact that this great harlot has written on her forehead Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and of the abominations of the earth. That's what she is. She is Babylon the Great, the mother of godlessness. In God's sight, it's an abomination. It's written on her forehead, because that's what she is. And the fact that it's called a mystery means that it's symbolic or representative of Babylon. Babylon has a deeper meaning than just a city on the Euphrates. And we know from the Bible that the error, the abomination against God at Babel, was not what we would call a religion per se, as much as a social humanistic ideology. So we think about what was going on at the Tower of Babel, which is a reference to Babylon. So let's go to Genesis chapter 11. Now the whole earth used the same language and the same words. And it came about as they journeyed east that they found a plain in the land of Shinar, and they settled there. They said to one another, come, let us make bricks and burn them thoroughly. And they used the bricks for stone. They used tar for mortar. They said, come, let us build for ourselves a city and a tower whose top will reach into heaven, and let us make for ourselves a name. Otherwise, we'll be scattered abroad over the face of the whole earth. The Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the sons of men had built. The Lord said, behold, they are one people, and they all have the same language. And this is what they begin to do, and now nothing which they purpose to do will be impossible for them. Come, let us go down and confuse their language, so they will not understand one another's speech. So the Lord scattered them abroad from there over the face of the whole earth, and they stopped building the city. Therefore, its name was called Babel, because there the Lord confused the language of the whole earth, and from there the Lord scattered them abroad over the face of the whole earth. Well, the project seemed to be harmless. The people just wanted to build a central government, but it was about control. It was to build a city where the elites were in charge over the people rather than God's authority. It was the deification, the glorification of man, a monument to human pride, and that's why it was abomination, an abomination to God. Now, when it says that we may build a tower to reach into heaven, they did not believe they were going to be climbing into heaven. It's just reflecting, they're building a tower that's going to be tall and reaching up into the sky. But whenever man gets together to create an empire, it always reflects man's sinful bent. Remember Cain? He went out from the presence of the Lord and built his own city where he could sustain himself apart from God. But God was not going to allow man to succeed in this, at least not yet. So he changed the language, the languages, and scattered the people. And if we think about this miracle of God, instantaneously changing the memory of everyone on earth, that demonstrates how serious and how spiritually and morally dangerous this Babel ideology was, that it would take such a miracle of God to divide everyone up. So 6 times in human history, people have tried to form an empire: ancient Babylon, Assyria, Neo-Babylon, Persia, Greece, and Rome. But God has eventually ended all these empires. Therefore, it could be said in John's day, 5 have fallen and 1 is. What's the empire that is during the days of John? The Roman Empire. And another has not yet come, the final empire, which is the empire of the Antichrist. But the point here is to reflect upon this ideology of globalism and humanism, human perfection and human power, rather than humbly looking to the coming kingdom of Christ. Have you ever been to the United Nations and taken time to read all of the posters and the plaques? Last time I was there, I was touring the building with a homeschool group, and there on the walls of the UN were all of the typical sloganeering, those statements that Christians would just reject out of hand: save the planet from global warming, you know, stop population explosion, unite the world to bring peace, end fossil fuels, you know, free Palestine, human rights for LGBTQ, coexist. Most people touring thought that was wonderful, but those who know God and the true gospel see it as otherwise. We should also be aware that this woman riding a beast is depicted throughout the EU in front of many of the European Union buildings. The 25th commemorative stamp for the European Union was a woman sitting on a beast. Now, the beast doesn't have 10 horns, but has 10 flowers on its head, and it's riding on waters and on 7 mountains or waves. In fact, I have that EU stamp. I ordered it many years ago when it first came out. I just put it on a plaque. I keep it in my office as just an example of some prophetic application and for what that's worth. Why symbolize Europe as a woman riding on a beast? Well, that image is thousands of years old. According to Greek legend, Europa was a Phoenician princess. And Zeus transformed himself into a bull and carried Europa off to Crete. And there she gave birth to Minos, the founder of the European people. So that's the legend. And this week I was reading an interesting article called Europa and the Bull, the significance of myth in modern Europe. Quote, the famous myth of Europa and the bull has frequently been alluded to and used by the European Union. Although a tale about an abduction and assault does not seem a logical choice for a project of peace and prosperity, the myth has a significant symbolic value for the region. Not only is the icon multi-interpretable, making it a popular communication tool for politicians, it also makes a statement of continuity. New Europe is still the old Europe, with a long tradition that goes back to ancient Greece. Far from being a purely decorative motif, Europa on a bull is a political symbol. It serves as a good example of how a classic myth can operate as a powerful ideological tool. It also shows how people of the modern world are not just analyzers of ancient myths. We actively use and exploit classic myths. European politicians rely on myths to get their message across. So today, people in the world understand the power of symbolism. Don't underestimate the relevance of the Bible using this image of a woman on a beast. It was well understood in the ancient world. The article goes on to state that the symbolism of Europa on the bull can mean many different things depending on how you want to see it. The first version of the myth is the rape of Europa. The bull represents the extreme forces of nationalism, violence, and oppression embodied in Nazism. In this version, Europa is portrayed as a victim of brutal force to which she reacts in vain. The interpretation provides foundation for a united Europe. It shows how European integration will help to overcome evil forces, do away with nation states and nationalism. The second interpretation of the myth was created after World War II. It's kind of the idea here is that it's the liberation of Europe and the United States of the bull, carrying Europa off to safety. The last version of the myth is the transition of Europa, sees the myth as Europe's journey forward. Well, the Bible explains the true meaning of the myth. Remember, Daniel explained to Nebuchadnezzar the true meaning of his vision. Well, the woman is false teaching, idolatry, satanic religion, riding on the back of governments. Now, does this mean that the kingdom of the Antichrist will be coming out of Europe? That's been the consensus since the prophecy in Daniel depicts the kingdom of the Antichrist coming out of the 10 nations that came out of the Roman Empire. But we're just going to have to wait and see. Most likely, even if the empire of the Antichrist has European roots, the empire is going to be worldwide. Now, we would not be complete in covering this text unless we look at the references in the Bible to the religion of Babylon. Are we familiar with those references in the Bible to the religion coming out of ancient Babel? Well, here are some texts. Even though Babel was based on a humanistic ideology, it was also the progenitor of a false religion that spread throughout the world. Babylon the Great, mentioned in Genesis 11, was founded by Nimrod. And out of that empire, a false religion was developed. And it's referenced in Ezekiel 8:14. Then the Spirit of God brought me to the entrance of the gate of the Lord's house, the temple in Jerusalem, which was toward the north. And behold, women were sitting there weeping for Tammuz. Keep that in mind. Why are these Israeli women weeping for Tammuz? Why are they worshiping her in the temple? Jeremiah 7:18, the children gather wood, and the fathers kindle the fire, and the women knead dough to make cakes for the queen of heaven. And they pour out drink offerings to other gods in order to spite me. So the Israelites were turning from the worship of Jehovah, and they were worshiping the queen of heaven. Then in Jeremiah 44:17, But rather we will certainly carry out every word that has proceeded from our mouths by burning sacrifices to the queen of heaven and pouring out drink offerings to her. just as we ourselves, our forefathers, our kings, and our princes did in the cities of Judah and in the streets of Jerusalem. So this was a very prevalent false religion. Now, according to the cult of Babylon, Nimrod had a wife whose name was Semiramis. And Nimrod died, and the queen had a son that she claimed to be virgin born. And the son's name was Tammuz, and she said that he's a reincarnation of Nimrod. And Semiramis claimed to be the queen of heaven. And this cult of worshiping the mother and child spread and appeared under various names. In Egypt, it was Isis and Osiris. In India, it was Isi and Iswara. In Asia, it was Sibel and Dionysus. In Rome, it was Fortuna and Jupiter. In Greece, it was Ceres. And in Ephesus, it was Artemis. So was this pre-gospel, a story about a mother bearing a virgin son? Well, no, because even the Old Testament points out that this was idolatry. This was a satanic substitute. This was the false worship of fertility and humanity, which was abomination to God. There's a fellow who wrote a book called Two Babylons, and he writes there that when the Far East was opened to the West in the 18th century, Catholic Jesuit missionaries were surprised to find in Tibet statues of Mary and her child as devoutly worshipped as in Papal Rome. But it wasn't Jesus they were worshipping, but they were worshipping the Queen of Heaven and her child, Tammuz, the worship of fertility and motherhood. So it's no wonder that the Reformers viewed the Roman Catholic Church and their worship of Mary as being part of the beast and part of the Antichrist, substituting Mary as the mediatrix between God and man. Verse 6 of chapter 17, "And I saw the woman drunk with the blood of the saints, with the blood of the witnesses of Jesus. When I saw her, I wondered greatly." What is the Apostle John amazed at? Well, it seems to be the amazement is over the persecution of God's people by this false religion, the imposter bride of Christ. One commentator says it this way: apostate Christendom, false religion, I would even add secular ideology, is unsparing in its persecution of those who attempt to maintain the true faith of Jesus Christ. What has been true in the past will be brought to its ultimate in future times, when martyrs will be beyond number from every nation, such as martyrs who refuse to worship the beast in the Great Tribulation. I always enjoy or appreciate that quote from George Orwell, where he points out that religion and ideology is what gives people the justification to do the worst kinds of evil in this world. It's ideology that inspires evil people to do even more evil and persecute the church of God. Even as Jesus said, those who kill you will think they're doing God a favor. Then in verse 7, the angel goes on to say, "I will explain to you exactly what you're dealing with in regard to this great harlot and the beast she rides upon. Why do you wonder? I will tell you the mystery of the woman and of the beast that carries her, which has the 7 heads and the 10 horns." So not only does the Bible give us these symbolic images, these word pictures, these object lessons, it then goes on to explain exactly what they mean. Now remember, we understood from chapter 13 and in the book of Daniel that the beast is the government, and Revelation 17:8, the beast that you saw was and is not and is about to come up out of the abyss and go to destruction. Those who dwell on the earth, whose names have not been written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, will wonder when they see the beast that he was and is not and will come. The empire of man, a global empire, used to exist. The last great empire was Rome, but it's going to be revived, and the people of the world will be enthralled at this new global government. And again, the commentary is that this coming empire and its agenda will separate between those who are the followers of Christ and those who are the followers of man and Satan. Verse 9, "Here's the mind that has wisdom. The 7 heads are 7 mountains on which the woman sits. And the 7 kings, and there are 7 kings, 5 have fallen, 1 is, and the other has not yet come. And when he comes, he must remain a little while. Here is the mind that has wisdom." We saw that in Revelation 13:18 in regard to the mark of the beast. "Here's wisdom, let him who understands calculate the number of the beast." So this statement anticipates that the reader will not understand this unless they have some wisdom, some biblical wisdom, some wisdom concerning history. There are 7 mountains on which the harlot sits. And in the Old Testament, Empires and kingdoms were often referred to as mountains. Jeremiah 51, speaking of the nation of Babylon, "I'm against you, O destroying mountain," calling Babylon a mountain, "who destroys the whole earth," declares the Lord. "And I will stretch out my hand against you and roll you down from the crags, and I will make you a burnt out mountain." Also, Daniel 2:35, it refers to the kingdom of Christ as a great mountain that fills the whole earth. Now, some see this reference to the seven mountains as the city of Rome, because Rome is known as the city of seven hills. But the best interpretation is that these seven mountains represent the seven great empires in world history. And the seven kings are the founders or the heads of these seven empires: Nimrod, Sennacherib, Nebuchadnezzar, Darius, Alexander the Great, Caesar. And the capital of the Antichrist, this seventh empire, is probably not literal Babylon in Iraq. Now, although the scripture does speak about literal Babylon, you notice here in the text, it also speaks about mystery Babylon, the spirit and the ideology of Babylon. Remember Revelation chapter 11, the great city where the two prophets are killed are mystically called Sodom and Egypt. But what city is being referred to? Jerusalem. Well, in the same way, when it refers to Babylon here, it's referring to the world system. And here's another interesting text where Peter ends his epistle in 1 Peter 5:13. He says, "She who is in Babylon, chosen together with you, sends you greeting, and so does my mother Mark, so does my son Mark." So was the Apostle Peter ministering in Babylon in the Euphrates River? Most commentators believe that he's referring to Rome here, but he's calling Rome Babylon. It's the belly of the beast. Notice also in the text, it says that this seventh kingdom will only last for a little while. Other empires lasted for some centuries, but this coming kingdom is going to be brief. Verse 11, "The beast which was and is not is also an eighth and is one of the seventh, and he goes to destruction." So the global empire of the Antichrist would be the seventh world empire, but it's also an eighth. Some people see it this way, that the seventh is the empire, while the eighth is the Antichrist himself. But I've never been satisfied with any commentaries as far as their answer on this. So if you have a good answer for verse 11, let me know afterwards, because I've never been able to figure that one out, how it could be the seventh and also the eighth. Not that it matters that much as far as my Christian walk, but we're always left with some mysteries. Verse 12 is very clear. The empire of the beast will be a confederation of 10 nations. As in Nebuchadnezzar's vision of the statue of man, out of Rome comes 10 kings, and the 10 horns which you saw are 10 kings, who have not yet received the kingdom, but they receive authority as kings with the beast for 1 hour. These have one purpose, and they give their power and authority to the beast. So here the Christians are simply told beforehand how the empire will come together, so that when they see it, they know the signs of the time. Verse 14, "These will wage war against the Lamb, and the Lamb will overcome them, because he is Lord of lords and King of kings. And those who are with him are the called and chosen and faithful. And he said to me, 'The waters which you saw where the harlot sits are people and multitudes and nations and tongues.'" So this is a reminder, as we read previously in the Revelation and even in the prophecy of Daniel, that this final empire will have an anti-God, anti-Christ agenda. They will wage war against the Lamb. And this kingdom will, in the end, literally wage war against Christ. And notice in verse 15 that this is not an isolated rebellion against God, but it's global, many people and nations. Now, the final explanation of the great harlot and the beast is unexpected. "And the 10 horns which you saw and the beast, these will hate the harlot and will make her desolate and naked and will eat her flesh and will burn her up with fire. For God has put it in their hearts to execute his purpose by having a common purpose and by giving their kingdom to the beast until the words of God will be fulfilled." So why would the 10 nations that come together to create this global empire eventually turn on the religion or the ideology or the ideologues who helped create this empire? Verse 2 says they were made drunk with this ideology, but now they turn on it. Now, one thought is 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, where it says that the Antichrist opposes and exalts himself above every so-called god or object of worship, so that he takes his seat in the temple of God, displaying himself as being God. So in the end, the Antichrist, Satan, doesn't want any humanism or any religion competing with pure Satanism. So the thought is that at some point, the Antichrist will destroy all religions, even the false religions that supported him. And those who know history know how often this happens in every regime, where totalitarian dictators eventually kill off all of the useful idiots who helped put them into power. As in the French Revolution, the ideological brains behind the French Revolution was Robespierre and the Jacobin Club, and they all went to the guillotine. And Stalin in Russia killed off many of the communists who helped put him into power. He even killed off Leon Trotsky, the leader of the Russian Revolution from 1917. So this text, even though it's about the future Antichrist, is a timeless warning to people in every age that if they support evil and they support revolution, they will eventually be killed by the very evil they support. Verse 17 tells us that this turning against the great harlot, false religion, false ideology, is God putting it into the hearts of the kings of the earth to execute his purpose. And in this, we see another case where God uses evil to punish evil. Verse 18, the final verse, is that this woman, the false ideology, is associated very closely with the great city that reigns over the kings of the earth. And the great city is more than just a physical location and a lot of buildings. It is an ideological political force that's destined for destruction. So the question in the bulletin is, what timeless moral spiritual lessons are Christians to receive from Revelation 17 that build our faith and our Christ-like character? Now, 500 years ago in the Reformation, all the Reformed theologians could do was just take the text and apply it to the false religion of their day and address some overall principles. Now, for us today, what's happening here, we're being warned concerning the evil of false religion and its idolatry. Often, we don't realize how much of an abomination it is to God. And it's texts like this that awaken us to the evils that are lurking in the world. Reminds us how demonic humanism can be, how we're supposed to oppose it and war against it, and how it leads to the persecution of God's people, which is no small thing. But also, we're encouraged it's not going to succeed. It'll be defeated by Christ. And that's chapter 18, the fall of Babylon, the world system, an entire chapter dedicated to the fall of Babylon, because the world is passing away. But he that does the will of God abides forever.